Where do you turn for answers in times of uncertainty? In a world of post-truth and alternative facts, more people are looking for truth in, of all places, the dictionary. In January, Merriam-Webster experienced a surge in popularity on social media when their tweet defining a fact received 61,000 likes and was retweeted 49,000 times. Ben Zimmer, the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal, joins us again to discuss how dictionaries are making themselves relevant again through social media and other digital tools, and how they're fighting against the erosion of language. I'm pleased to welcome Ben Zimmer back to our show. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. Always great to be here.
And to our audience, if you have any questions about language, word origins, or dictionaries, want to join the conversation, give us a call, 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WMIC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Thopate. What was Merriam-Webster's reaction online after Kellyanne Conway first used the phrase alternative facts?
Well, Merriam-Webster does what it often does, which is to check on words in the news based on what people are looking up. They see spikes of interest in particular words, and they measure this by quantitatively. They can look at their data in terms of what words are getting looked up. So when Kellyanne Conway made her famous remark about alternative facts, the word fact got a spike in lookups. People wanted to look up in the dictionary at that moment. Well, how do you define a fact? Can you have an alternative fact? Does that even make sense? And so because of that, they reacted to this spike in lookups on their online dictionary by writing up what they call a trend watch piece. This is just sort of words in the news. And so they talked about, you know, why people were looking up fact because of Kellyanne Conway. This is our, you know, our definition. This is, you know, the origin of the word fact. Just, you know, basic fact.
They said a fact is a piece of information presented as having objective reality.
Right.
In other words, it couldn't be alternative.
Well, yeah. And so what they did was on Twitter, they put out that definition of the word fact, linking to this Trendwatch piece about Kellyanne Conway. And just by virtue of doing that, by tweeting out this definition of what a fact is and you know, linking it to the story by Kellyanne Conway, that was seen as, people called it throwing shade, which means like a subtle kind of disrespect, or, you know, trolling her, you know, different ways of that people saw that act of simply putting out a definition on Twitter as being a kind of a subversive act. And perhaps in this day and age, presenting, a simple dictionary definition can, in fact, be subversive.
Of course, this couldn't have happened in the past. People would have opened their dictionary, the book, and nobody would have known that they looked up the word fact.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, for most of dictionaries' histories, they were just print objects, and now they're online products which have this kind of interaction with their users that can be measured, and so there can be this interactivity, and there can be a kind of a response from the dictionary to people who are looking up words and talking about words.
Do you think people were surprised that Merriam-Webster had a social media presence with attitude?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think all the dictionary publishers kind of have jumped on social media in various ways. And typically, though, what it might be is simply like putting out the word of the day, something basic like that. But in the past year or two, we've seen Merriam-Webster, Dictionary.com, and others using social media, perhaps, as you say, with a little more attitude, with a little more edge. At times, it can sound a little snarky. That kind of edgy voice is not necessarily one that people associate with the dictionary as they think about it. So it can seem a little incongruous, but I think that's part of the appeal of these tweets from Merriam-Webster, for instance, that people think, oh my goodness, the dictionary, you know, because they sort of think of it as this big monolithic entity. The dictionary is responding to Trump or Kellyanne Conway.
Although it's also part, I imagine, of Merriam-Webster's new marketing strategy, a way of calling attention to itself.
Absolutely. I mean, yes. Dictionaries do have a hard time sort of drawing attention to themselves. There aren't that many PR opportunities for dictionaries to take. So typically what happens, a dictionary might release a batch of new words, and that's a moment when It gets a bit of attention.
And then when they include slang, they get attention in another way. People are outraged sometimes.
They might be outraged, or they might just be surprised that the latest millennial slang, whether it's, you know, on fleek or something like that, or squad goals, whatever, is in Merriam-Webster or Oxford Dictionaries or one of these major publishers. And, you know, that's not surprising. That should not be surprising, because dictionaries have always tried to keep abreast with the latest developments in language. You know, so when it's announced, here are our new words, that's a PR opportunity, a marketing opportunity. But what we see now with something like Merriam-Webster's social media presence is there can be this kind of ongoing dialogue, which is great for marketing purposes, for sure, and for driving people to the website.
You mentioned that some of the other dictionaries also have online presences, but they haven't been responding as immediately to things like the Kellyanne Conway remark. And there have been some others recently as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Merriam-Webster has done a great job in terms of being very agile in its response. And so when there's something going on, whether it's a presidential debate or something else in the news, they've been very quick to create these trend watch pieces and tweet them out so that, you know, they have something for people who are talking about a particular word. So if Hillary Clinton said basket of deplorables, for instance, you know, they would put something out about the word deplorable, that sort of thing.
Well, people started looking up deplorable, but was the issue there that she was using it as a noun instead of as an adjective?
Right, yeah. So again, from the kind of the lexicographic perspective, what's interesting there is that she's using it as a noun, and that's not something that you would find in any of the major dictionaries. People don't tend to use that word deplorable as a noun, but now they do, because that remark from Hillary Clinton got so much attention. That was an opportunity for Merriam-Webster and other dictionary publishers to say, well, this is the way we define the word deplorable, but look, it's moving off in this new direction now.
How much of it is just that people start using a word in a certain way? For example, the word impacted, something I resist saying personally because it feels uncomfortable for me to say it. Yeah. I can say, what is the impact, or has it affected, is right. What I would say. But does impacted suddenly become an acceptable word? Or another case, the media. The media, which media is plural word, mm-hmm. medium is the singular. Now we hear that the media is instead mm-hmm. of the media are.
Right. Well, both of those cases are ones that often show up on people's pet peeves, and they often engage with dictionaries to see, well, how dare you include impact as a verb, or how dare you...
But they are including them now.
Yes, absolutely, because that's the way people use the language, and that's what dictionaries are supposed to reflect. The goal is descriptivist, not prescriptivist, which means that it's reflecting the way people actually use language. And these changes that may appear sudden, in fact, may have quite a long history to them. Impact as a verb, media as a singular noun are both cases where you can actually look at the evidence and see a long history of this, even though it may seem like something that just recently happened.
And then in time, people forget. For example, when I first started doing this show and we had language segments, the word that outraged a lot of people was hopefully.
Right.
Now nobody complains about the use of the word hopefully.
Well, some people still do.
Really?
They've moved on to other adverbs. Literally is probably the adverb that people complain the most about. But I still occasionally hear complaints about hopefully.
But that's because of the way literally is being used. People just throw it into the middle of a sentence.
Right.
When we just assume that what they're saying is the fact, there's no reason to say literally.
Right. Well, it's moving in another direction. But again, that's one where literally gets used as a kind of an intensifier in a way that is different from simply talking about the literal meaning of something. And that's kind of looser usage of one is, again, something that has been percolating in the language for centuries, in fact.
People have been saying it's really.
Yes.
Isn't that pretty much the same thing?
It is if you think about it, but people don't
exactly
complain.
Or exactly is another one.
Right.
What exactly is the – well, if I'm asking you what the population of Nome, Alaska is, do I have to say what exactly is the population of Nome, Alaska? And yet a lot of people will throw in that word exactly.
Right. So these adverbs sometimes get thrown in, as you say, exactly, really, literally, in a way that people are using it as a form of intensification without necessarily thinking specifically about what that word means.
My guest is Ben Zimmer, who is the language columnist for the Wall Street Journal. and he visits us on a fairly regular basis. Today we're talking about why dictionaries are making a comeback. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I know about Webster and dictionaries, but who was Merriam, and when did the Merriam-Webster dictionary begin?
Well, that all took place in the mid-19th century, really. So, you know, Noah Webster was sort of the father of American lexicography and created the most widely read dictionaries in the U.S. starting in the early 19th century. Who was going to continue his legacy? Well, it turned out that the Merriam brothers, who set up shop in Springfield, Massachusetts, were the ones to take Noah Webster's dictionaries and be sort of the official, the continuation of that. But in fact, Noah Webster's name is now available for any dictionary publisher to use. And so if you go to a bookstore or look on Amazon and you just look up Webster's dictionary, you might find all sorts of different dictionary publishers using that name, since it's no longer specific. It's no longer something that just Merriam
can use. You can't copyright the Noah Webster's name.
You can't trademark it. Yeah, that's correct. I mean, that it fell out of it fell into generic use, basically, so any publisher can use it. But Merriam-Webster is the one who, you know, sort of officially has taken the mantle from Noah Webster.
You wrote about dictionaries in a New York Times op-ed in 2012, and the popular belief that the dictionary is the only monolithic authority. Is that close to reality?
Not really, because people again think of the dictionary, but you know what that conflates is all the different dictionary publishers. So in the United States, we've talked about Merriam-Webster. There's American Heritage. Random House used to make dictionaries. They closed up shop, but now Dictionary.com actually uses Random House dictionary resources. You have UK publishers like Oxford and Cambridge, which also create dictionaries for the US market. And when I was a lexicographer, I was editor for American Dictionaries at Oxford University Press. And so there are all sorts of different companies that are working on this in different ways.
They don't always agree either.
Not necessarily, yeah. And they take different approaches, for instance, in perhaps how quickly new words will be entered in the dictionary. Some dictionaries are a bit more conservative in that way, and some will sort of do that whole process of taking in new words more quickly. We see that these days, like we were saying, with sort of batches of new words that the different dictionary publishers come up with.
You recently wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal about the origins of alternative facts. Does it really date back to the 16th century?
Well, I was looking there at the alternative part of alternative facts. I mean, people were talking about the word fact, and I was interested in the way that the word alternative has developed, where it comes out of this Latin root where it's really one thing and then the other, and that meaning still survives more in our word alternate or the verb alternate. But alternative became a word that got used over the centuries to refer to something that was outside of the mainstream, a choice that was not one that was sort of commonly made. We saw that especially starting in the 1960s counterculture, where the alternative press or alternative medicine and things like that became commonly used. And then into the 80s with things like alternative music, and you could shorten alternative just with alt. So there's this sort of interesting history behind the word alternative, so that when you hear something like alternative facts, and people were responding to that rather playfully sometimes referring to them as alt facts, again, using that shorter form, just thinking about, well, what does that word alternative really mean?
Well, I can understand alternative press.
Right.
It means that there's an establishment press and then there's somebody who comes along who has a different approach.
Right.
I can even understand alt-right, although many people object to it because they see it as just a way of covering up the fact that we're talking about something quite different. But how does alternative fact then fall into that? They're either a fact or they're not facts.
Right.
Isn't that what Merriam-Webster was saying?
Pretty much, yeah. And, you know, Kellyanne Conway later tried to clarify that. She was saying at the time they were talking about the size of the inauguration crowd, how big Trump's was, and she was defending Sean Spicer, And what she later clarified her comments to be was that she was presenting alternative information or another set of facts that might explain what Sean Spicer said at that time. But by putting it together as alternative facts, it did sound like an oxymoron. If you appreciate what a fact is, according to the dictionary definition, then how could you have alternative facts, especially with people talking about sort of the post-truth era that really kind of struck a nerve with people.
Let's take a call. Robert from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Lenny. As usual, I always enjoy your show. But I do have a pet peeve.
That, Robert.
Over the years, you've had a lot of guests talk about language and English specifically, and you a lot of times complain or people are aggravated by the use of a word and how it's changed. And basically the whole thing of language is it's a tool, to describe the world around us and what is happening. And because we have a world that's constantly changing with new technologies and new opinions and new thoughts, language is going to flex with that. And to feel that it should be sitting in a box somewhere in a museum to look from afar and say, oh, it's under glass, we can't change that, seems sort of ludicrous and ridiculous. And I think that's one of the issues that your guest book may be even pointing out to, or what he's trying to point to, and that is, one of the reasons dictionaries have fallen out of favor in the age of the internet is that the internet can very easily change quickly to allow a published word to see that change in meaning. And therefore, having it sit on a shelf somewhere in your house doesn't really fit the needs anymore.
I get your point, Robert, but you want to pursue that a bit further, and then yeah. I have some thoughts.
Sure. I mean, I think that's a good point to make, but I think that is actually, in fact, what is driving dictionary publishers to be more agile in responding to the way that language is changing. You know, dictionaries have, again, always tried to keep up with these things. And, you know, sometimes they lag behind the curve just a bit because, you know, they're often looking to see, well, does a particular word have a track record before we enter it into our dictionary or enter a new sense into our dictionary? These days, things change very rapidly, and a dictionary that was published just 5 or 10 years ago may lack the sort of the latest developments. And certainly lexicographers are painfully aware of how quickly these things can change, how language is, in fact, a constantly shifting target. And so it's hard to simply just treat it as something that's, as the caller said, kind of a museum piece that's kept under glass. Since it is constantly changing, how best can we document those changes? And it can be a slippery subject and sometimes very difficult for dictionaries to deal with.
In some cases, a word describes a new thing, like hashtag.
Sure.
But in other cases, you mentioned literally before, doesn't that just muddy up the sentence and make it less clear? Shouldn't our goal ultimately be to be as clear as possible? I would think that in the interest of making things as clear as possible, for example, I mentioned media as a plural. The media represents the press, it represents radio, television, the full range. So we should think of it as not as, when we say the media is, we're then making it monolithic instead of a group of things. We're actually being less clear.
Well, you could make that argument, but I was just listening to what you
said. I just made
what
that argument.
Yes, but in making that argument, you actually used media singular. You said the media represents it, and you used the word it as a singular pronoun. So you made your point perfectly well by treating media grammatically as a singular noun. And, you know, we have plenty of nouns that were plural in Latin, which are now treated singularly. Should we treat the word agenda plural as a plural just simply because it used to be one in Latin? Well, of course not, because as it developed in English, it became a singular noun. And so something similar is happening with media, despite objections to that change. And so, you know, as the caller said, I mean, you can't stop these changes from happening. You know, there you can make sort of prescriptions that language should not be used a particular way, but that very often, will not have any effect on the way people use language in a popular way.
And then there's the whole matter. I'm assuming that Robert is one of those people who would also feel, as you wrote about in your op-ed piece in the Times, that words are, some people feel words are made by cloak and dagger cabals full of deep, dark secrets.
Well, that's part of the popular image people have of dictionaries. First, that they anoint new words, they make them official. When, of course, if you talk to a lexicographer, they'll say, well, we don't make words official. We're simply recognizing words that are out there, and it's, you know, people using the word that leads to its entry in a dictionary. But this idea of the dictionary as the gatekeeper for new language, new forms, words and phrases means that sometimes it's thought of as, yeah, as I said, the sort of shadowy cabal that's making these decisions about what a word should be, what, you know, what's allowed into the dictionary in an official capacity.
I'm speaking with Ben Zimmer, the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. And we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. We're specifically interested in political language these days because so much of the debate centers around political language. But also, word origins are fascinating to me. And again, and correct usage, isn't it important to know where a word comes from so that you use it in a way that makes the most sense? We'll take a little break and come back with more calls and with your answer to that and whatever else we can sneak in. We're back with Ben Zimmer, the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. We're talking about, well, the topic is why dictionaries are making a comeback, but we're broadening it to a discussion of words in general. And before I get to the calls, we did have a little question before we went to the break. How does Ben Carson's use of the word immigrant apply to this conversation? People are going to the dictionary to see whether a slave could be an immigrant.
That's right. So there was a bit of a controversy when Ben Carson, who's now the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, in a speech was saying, talking about immigrants who come here in the bottom of slave ships. And so that raised the question, are enslaved people immigrants? Can you call them immigrants? And so what is the definition of an immigrant? That is the type of question that will make people go to their, you know, favorite dictionary, whether online or in print.
Well, he's defended himself, but doesn't the dictionary say an immigrant is someone who comes to another place and by choice?
The dictionary definitions don't explicitly say by choice. So this is a question of connotation, perhaps, more than denotation. So if the dictionary definition is simply a person who comes to a country to take up permanent residence there, does that imply that it's a voluntary act of agency? Most people would not think so. That people who are brought involuntarily to a country, that should not, you know, be part of the definition of immigrant.
And then bought and sold.
Exactly, yeah. So this is the kind of controversy that can come up over a dictionary definition. Like, the dictionary publishers then have to decide, well, maybe our definition of the word immigrant is not precise enough. Maybe we should fine-tune it a bit to be more explicit about the fact that when people say immigrant, they tend to mean someone who voluntarily comes to a country from another one.
Should we take some more calls? Eve from Westport, Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Hello, Ben. I was just calling because I responded to that other caller's comment that people don't use dictionaries anymore. I thought that was very striking because, of course, they do. People use dictionaries all the time. I use a dictionary. Everybody I know uses a dictionary.
Are you looking? Do you use a book or do you go online?
Well, I would use a book, except that I'm always online. So I use online. I use my regularly. I use my Apple dictionary, which has option of different dictionaries that I can put into it. So I have an English and I have a American thesaurus, a British thesaurus, and I speak a foreign language, so I also have that dictionary. But if I'm not home and I'm using a work computer, I'll just go on the internet and use, you know, whatever dictionary comes up, whether it's Macmillan or thesaurus.com or dictionary.com, and then of course the meaning of a word For example, you know, understanding if immigrant is can be used as, you know, involuntarily going to another country, being or a slave, for example. I would look that up, looking up on the dictionary.
Right, and that's the way that most people are using dictionaries these days. And so I think that dictionaries do have this kind of relevance in people's daily lives, and the fact that they're so readily available online, or as the caller said, it could be built into your operating system. If you have a Mac, then Apple actually uses Oxford's dictionary data for that. Google also, if you look up a Google definition, even though it doesn't say it, you're actually seeing definitions that come from Oxford dictionaries as well. And so dictionary data can be accessed in all these different ways now. It doesn't require, you know, pulling the dictionary off the shelf. So that means that, you know, very often dictionaries can have this kind of relevance, especially when people are arguing over disputed words. Looking up a word in a dictionary doesn't mean you're not familiar with it. You could be very familiar with it, but you want to understand a fuzzy concept that word represents.
In a recent New York Times column, Catherine Rossman wrote that Americans were looking up the word impugn after Senator Elizabeth Warren was silenced by her Republican colleagues when she attempted to read a letter aloud by Coretta Scott King that was critical of Jeff Sessions. Do we know what other words people have been looking up lately? And why would impugn be something that they would even look up?
Well, I mean, that's a good case where, I mean, you know, impugn, you can think of that as a bit more advanced. It's not part of people's everyday vocabulary. You don't run across it very often. You know, it may be seen as more formal or literary. So words like that are the typical ones that people look up, where they're like, well, I know I've heard that word, but what exactly does it mean? Or another example would be, again, with the whole Jeff Sessions story, when he recused himself from any investigations involving the 2016 campaign. You know, that drove the lookups to the online dictionaries for the word recuse. It's a word that people have, you know, heard, but they just want to be specific about what this word is that's floating around in the news, and so they'll turn to the dictionary to find out.
And you recently wrote in your Wall Street column about the word gaggle, which it relates to what Sean Spicer has been doing recently.
It came up in the news when the White House excluded certain news outlets like the New York Times and CNN from a press gaggle. And if you're not part of the Beltway, you might not understand what that means.
Because gaggle refers to a flock of geese.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But starting in the early Clinton administration, they started using this word gaggle to refer to these informal, off-camera press availabilities that the press secretary would have, as opposed to the, you know, the formal on-camera press briefings in the briefing room. And so that was something that Dee Dee Myers, you know, President Clinton's first press secretary, sort of came up with as a kind of a lighthearted way to refer to these informal gatherings of reporters. But now it's become this more official thing. And so suddenly, you know, so the story comes out that these news organizations are being excluded from the gaggle, and people who are not familiar with this sort of White House lingo are wondering, why are we calling this a gaggle? So that's the type of story that I like to look at to see how did we get from the gaggle of geese, which dates back to the actually to a collective noun, I think, from the 15th century, to a gaggle of reporters, and then the sort of the name of the press gaggle being used by the White House.
Sally from Queens, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Oh, thank you so much. I have to say, what old is new again, and I loved reading books by George Eliot and Jane Austen, and these women had political thoughts and political ideas, and they had just everyday notions, and I was lucky enough to get a 1904 copyright dictionary to look up, but I noticed no photographs but etchings of all these words and all these ideas that I didn't know even existed. I got lost in a move. Does Merriam-Webster have a way to dial it back so that we get back to the early 1900s? Oh, this is what that meant then.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, the Merriam-Webster dictionary, both this, you know, the collegiate, which most people are familiar with, as well as its unabridged dictionary does a historical ordering of its definitions. So if you're reading through just a dictionary entry for Merriam-Webster, you're actually getting the sort of the historical progress of a word. But it is, I agree, it's fascinating to look at an old dictionary and see the way that these words were defined in a bygone era. You know, I as a kid, I love just sort of consulting old dictionaries. And so if you look in, say, the first edition of that Webster's Unabridged Dictionary from that may be the one that the caller is talking about, or, you know, the second edition, which came out in the 1930s. It's fascinating to see the way that these things have changed and, you know, how the whole idea of what a dictionary definition should be has also changed over the years. You can actually get a lot of these older dictionaries online. A lot of these have been scanned and digitized. So if you look, I believe, you know, some of those, for instance, that first edition of Webster's Unabridged would be available because it's in the public domain now. Anything, you know, earlier than 1923 can be shared for free online. And so that can be sort of a fun resource to go back and look at those old dictionaries and see the way that they used to define words.
Bill Weinberg from Lower Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hi. I must object in the strongest terms to the notion that we must acquiesce in error simply because it is widespread. If meaning is to be defined by usage, no matter how slovenly that usage becomes, what is the point of having dictionaries or lexicographers at all? Media is plural. It makes no sense for media to be singular. If the word literally is merely to be taken as a superlative, then how do you actually say literally? If you follow this logic, we are going to have to start accepting the widespread use of epitaph for epithet. We're going to have to start accepting the widespread use of succession for secession. We're going to have to start accepting the widespread use of reflexive for reflective. You, sir, are abdicating your responsibility to the English language.
And I think Bill's point about what happens when you misuse literally or just throw it around, what happens to the word literally when you're actually using it correctly? Are you just undermining its meaning?
Well, in the case of a word where we can see that there has been a change in the popular understanding of a word, sometimes we come to a situation where using it in the traditional way can be misunderstood by people who have taken on a more modern understanding of it. And so that does become an issue. Sometimes there are certain words that people argue about, which, you know, sometimes people just decide to avoid them in writing because there is an older sense of it and a newer sense of it, and whichever one you use, you may be sort of misunderstood by the other side. But to the caller's point, it's not an abdication of responsibility to point out that language changes, to point out that not every Latin plural ending in A has remained a plural in the English language, and that these things change over time. And, you know, not just with media, but we see similar arguments over the word data is versus data are, and that sort of thing. And you know, sometimes these are ongoing disputes, and what a dictionary can do is to say, here is what the traditional understanding of a word might be, and to provide a kind of a usage note very often to say, if you use it in this newer way, you run the risk of being, treated in such a way that usage is seen as non-standard or in error. And there are cases where we can, the caller pointed to some cases of sort of erroneous substitutions of one word for another. Dictionaries can point out to easily confused words, but they can also point to cases where we can actually see semantic shifts going on in particular words, whether we like those shifts or not.
When I first began doing the show, a listener complained on the air that I used the word none both in the singular and the plural. And another listener called in and said, well, I've looked that up, and it turns out that we've been using it both ways since the 13th century.
Yeah, exactly.
So this process is, even though none comes from no one, this process has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, that's a great example because, yes, you can go back to the origins of that word none. This is if you wanted to go back that far, and find its root in basically the equivalent of no one. But that form, even way back then, could be used as a singular or a plural with a verb that agrees in that way. And it was only actually in the 19th century that people started complaining and saying none should only be used with a singular verb. You should only say none is rather than none are. And, you know, that's a good case where, you know, something has been happening for centuries before anyone even bothered to complain about it. But then once it enters people's consciousness and as something that is wrong, they will point to that as an error, even though, again, there's no confusion if you use a plural verb with none. Everyone will understand what you mean, but once it becomes sort of a sticking point, people will point to it as an error, sometimes as a way to sort of feel like they have a sort of a greater linguistic understanding, and other people are using the language in an incorrect way.
We've run out of time, but a number of people have called in and suggested that the language is different for different people in this country.
Absolutely.
And that's something that can be both confusing, but also maybe perhaps even enriching. My thanks to Ben Zimmer. We'll hope to see you again soon. Ben Zimmer is the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal.
Thank you.